Bethany Rutter with another episode of What Page Are You On? I'm here with my good friend and business partner.
Hello, it's me, Alice Slater.
It is you, Alice Slater.
It's me, and it's you.
Can you believe that we've been doing this for 6 weeks already, this weekly episode thing?
I actually can't.
How good is that? We've been providing quality weekly content to people in their ear holes for 6 weeks.
It feels like it's been 5 minutes, but also I feel like we live together now.
So true.
You know, there's like nothing in between.
Yeah, because it's like I see Beth every so often, IRL, and we have our little weekly chats on our podcast. And then there's Jenny Tighe, who is the fourth member of our little crew. And I feel like I haven't seen her in about 10 years.
Oh, that breaks my heart.
Sad, isn't it?
Yeah.
Hi, Jenny, if you're listening.
It's like very niche content now.
This is just for our friends.
We've got too big for our boots and have just started recording absolute shit.
Just chats. So at the time of recording, which is Wednesday, i.e. 2 days before the episode is put out, we are doing extremely well on our little Book Trust fundraiser, which closes today on the day that the podcast is being broadcast, as in your today, not our today. And I am very hopeful that by the time we end the fundraiser at lunchtime-ish on Friday, the 11th of December, that we will have hit £2,000. Do you think this will happen, Alice?
I believe it will happen.
We have less than £100 to go to hit £2,000, which is just absolutely wild.
Can I set a new goal?
Please set a new goal.
My dream is let's get 2020. 2020.
2020. That is so nice. Yeah, if we raised £2,000, that would buy 200 books for vulnerable children and children in care. How cool is that?
That's amazing.
All on the lovely people that listen to this pod and that follow us on social media.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Thank you to my friends. You've had a good day today, haven't you, Alice? Would you like to tell us about it?
I've had such a good day today. Today, I signed with an agent. I have a literary agent now.
She's represented.
She's represented. I'm represented by Zoe Ross at United Agents. And I just couldn't be happier. It's so exciting.
I'm hyped for you. And I'm also hyped for like the world, because this means that you are now on the path to publishing things in book form, in novel form.
I'm one step closer
to my dream of you being published. So that is the important part.
Exactly. Oh. Anyway, so yeah. Fun. There's still a lot of work ahead, but it's really good news. And I'm going to drink some champagne later and just, you know, celebrate a little win.
I'm having a celebratory takeaway later for my own reasons, but I will eat a single spoonful of dal in your honour.
What are you celebrating?
My first payment for a forthcoming unannounced project.
Oh, okay.
Once again, we're just making content for each other and our friends.
Anyway, enough of this nonsense.
I just wanted to distribute your news to a wider audience. the purpose of today's episode is to do our little 2020 roundup.
Books of the year.
So we've each assembled a list of 5 books that are our personal top 5. And between us, we will create a top 10.
Are we just going to dive right in? Are we not going to talk about what we're reading right now?
Well, I'm basically reading the same book I was reading last week because I've been working extremely hard on my earring creation, so I haven't had too much time for reading. But please tell me about what you're reading.
Well, in my ear holes, I'm reading The Vanishing Half. Mm. Just, you know, as an FYI, I started it a little while ago and then I got waylaid, but now I'm back on it and I'm loving it.
You may hear more about this book in this episode.
Yeah, and then with my little eye holes, I'm reading Severance by Ling Ma.
Oh, I really want to read that.
It's really good. It's about a Chinese-American millennial who has a really boring office job printing Bibles, and then a global pandemic wipes out, like, the majority of the human race. So it's, like, a very 2020 book, but it was written a couple of years ago.
I really want to read it. Yeah, I will get to that in my life.
Maybe I'll lend you my copy when I finish it.
Maybe if we see each other again in person.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
That'd be nice.
Yeah.
So I feel like let's do a little preamble chat about this year in books. Because I'm going to say it, It hasn't been a banner year.
Oh, I wish I didn't agree, but I was counting my books last night, everything that I've read, and I was like, I feel like there's not been as many. It hasn't been as difficult for me to compile this list as it normally would be. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, there hasn't been as much competition.
Exactly.
Are we reading less? Are we reading differently? Is it that, you know, there are just not as many interesting books out this year? Is it that things that we thought we were going to love, we turned out to not love? And we don't need to name names on that, because there are some that we really didn't like that we thought we would like. What do you think?
Well, in terms of reading, although the pandemic threw my reading off, I'm averaging about the same number of titles as I did last year.
Yeah,
I'm on 81. I normally finish at around 90. In terms of, I think I have read more backlists this year. So maybe it's just that I've read fewer 2020 titles than I read 2019 titles. But also, yeah, I just feel like I have been maybe not picking up as many bangers as I expected. I've had a few duds, duds.
We've had, you know, time for reading, and we have been reading. So if there were like new 2020 books out that we wanted to read, we would have read them. Do you know what I mean? It's not like we have not been prioritizing reading. It's just things that we thought were going to be good maybe weren't so good, and there weren't as many juicy tempting.
And I guess the way in which I have been picking up books has been different, because like we didn't go to any showcases. We didn't go to any book launches. Like, we didn't kind of interact with the literary world in the same way that we normally would. And, you know, I do think hearing a writer read from their work can often really sell it to you. So I don't know. I don't know if that's affected it. Although, to be honest, I mean, everything that I picked up, I think I would have picked up anyway. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's almost the opposite.
We had high hopes.
Anyway, one thing that I wanted to ask you about compiling this list. I saw a tweet the other day and I saw you favved it. And I was like, interesting. Yeah, I spy on you. It was a tweet that was like, when compiling your end of year lists, please consider including books that are more unsung, rather than just going with big bestsellers.
Yeah, and I think in general that for like people who work at newspapers and magazines and on the radio and TV, I think that is something that they should be doing. Us, we can do what we want because we don't matter, but yeah. I think that's a good practice.
Yeah, I mean, I just think it depends. If you're asked to contribute a single title to a compiled list, then I think you should go with something that's from an indie press or a book that maybe didn't receive the same kind of marketing budget as, you know, a lead title for a top five publisher, big five rather, publisher. But I just find it really hard not to kind of go with my gut. Like, my top five is, or my top 10 is like a list of books that really spoke to me that I will go and bat for. And there's lots of books I'd love and go bat for, but if you're asked for a top five, for me, it has to be my top five. I feel like it has to be kind of earnest.
Has to come from the heart.
Is that really boring and earnest? Does that just make me sound really wet?
I think it's true, but also I just don't think we wield the kind of, like, we communally probably make a difference in like a very small way to the sales of certain books. But I think if, like, you know, you're doing something for like The Times and you choose Richard Osman's Thursday Murder Club, you have to take a look at yourself. You know, like one of the 10 best-selling hardbacks of all time or something. Do you know what I mean? Like, that kind of thing. It's just like, that's a waste. That's just a waste of a spot.
But then I do wonder if I'd love to know, just basically, I'd love to know whether or not these book lists, end of year lists, make a big difference to sales. I feel like it seems like obvious that they would do, but demonstrably, how different?
I don't know.
If one of the top 10 bestsellers of the year wasn't included, would that not be a snub? Isn't that saying just as much?
Yeah, who knows, man? Who knows? I guess all of these lists are just subjective. It's just everyone making their own little top five. So, you know, are we snubbing big books by not including them?
Yes.
Deliberately, yes.
I guess I just feel like I've seen a lot of grumbling online about the nature of these lists and how they're compiled, which, you know, got me thinking, not just about my own list, because as I said, Mine is just an earnest list of 5 books that have changed me or that I will be carrying with me in one way or another at the end of the year. But yeah, this just seems like a lot of bad feeling, maybe. A lot of cynicism about them. I don't know.
Well, I didn't really have a lot of choice this year because, as we've said, there was not a huge amount of competition. And in many cases, things that I didn't put on my list, you have put on yours, which I would also have put on my list if I was asked to do a 10 rather than a 5.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think we've ended up with a top 10 that we as a pod will stand by.
I will stand by this.
All right, go on, you go first. Give me your first one.
And my first one is a book I have mentioned before, but so are they all. Discomfort of Evening by Marika Lukas-Reinewald. You have not read this book, is that correct?
No, I still haven't read it.
It's okay, you don't need to read it. I'm just checking, you know. I'm going to nutshell it again because we cannot assume that everybody listens to every F, even though they should. And Discomfort of Evening is about a child called Jazz who lives on a dairy farm in the Netherlands with her family, and her brother, early on in the book, dies in an ice skating accident. He drowns, and then the family just sort of disintegrates in this very isolated, strict Christian community. And it's just very dark and troubling and memorable and quite shocking and very, yeah, I found it quite challenging as a book. It is executed in a very successful way, I think. So that's my first pick, is The Discomfort of Evening by Marika Lukas-Reinewald, and it's translated from Dutch.
It's a little bit Marmite-y, from what I understand. Like, I think it's quite a bold choice for the top 5, you know? Like, I think it's one you really have to stand by. Not you, like, you know, no one's gonna... Anyway.
Yeah, I just think there haven't been that many, like, kind of hardcore literary fiction books this year that I have found really compelling.
Yeah, good choice, pal. Good choice.
That I did.
My first pick is one that I don't think you have read, if I am remembering correctly. I've gone with Boy Parts by Eliza Clark from Influx Press.
I started reading it and then for some reason had to desist reading it. I think maybe because I had to read something for an event. And then I didn't pick it up again because I'm a fool and I've just had to watch over the internet tell me how good it is. And I just need to finish reading it.
I enjoyed it so much. I'm actually now listening to the audiobook, which is read by the author.
Yeah, I think that's what I might do, actually. I think I'm
treat yourself.
Yeah, put Eliza Clark into my ear holes.
She reads it so well. I think we've talked about it before, but let me just nutshell it anyway. So it's about a woman called Irina who takes explicit photos of like pretty average looking men that she scouts from the streets of her hometown of Newcastle. So she gets this opportunity to exhibit her work at a fashionable Hackney art gallery. So between kind of druggy, boozy binging, she has to start digging through her archive to decide what she wants to put into this gallery. And this process triggers some pretty patchy recollections of times in which she may have taken things too far with some of her previous models. So it's basically like a Geordie Patrick Bateman whose primary inspiration is Boys by Charlie XCX. I think that's a good summary. And yeah, you know, the reason why I love it is because it's really voice driven. And that I realize is exactly what I want from a book. I want something that has a really striking voice. And yeah, I think Eliza writes brilliantly. It's really funny and dark and clever. I just love it.
I love this. I'm really hyped to listen to it because everyone I know has loved it. And I just feel so silly for not having completed my reading experience. And I also
the only thing I was just gonna say the only thing that I would say for our listeners and also for you specifically is that the main character is pretty fat phobic. But I feel like it's in keeping with the character. It didn't bother me as a reader, but I just wanted to flag that.
Yeah, I have room for that in my life. And I also I'm interested. I think it's quite unusual for an audiobook to be read by the author when it's fiction.
So I'm definitely
into that decision.
I'd love to know how that decision was made because she just reads so fucking well. Yeah. I'm like, did you audition for this or like what's the story? I'll ask her. Yeah.
So my next pick for my top 5 was Such a Fun Age by Kylie Reid.
Oh, such a fun book.
So once again, it is about a young black woman who is a babysitter/nanny for a white family, and one evening, she takes the child to a Whole Foods-like shop and is accused by a woman of kidnapping the child that she is looking after, and that sets off a chain of events that is very troublesome and makes a good story you read.
I sort of feel like as you described that, you started talking like a little robot.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. It's a very
books that's a real page turner without being a thriller, but I think there's things that you would not want to know going in that would spoil it for you.
Definitely. Which does make it quite difficult to talk about because you don't, I always forget what took me by surprise and what's just like part of the kind of landscape. But yeah, I think
that setup is as much as I would want to say without spoiling it.
Yeah. But I think in the last episode, we nutshelled it by saying that the incident is filmed. Yeah. And that kind of triggers the kind of drama that follows, but not as directly as you might think. It's just really smart and cool. And definitely like a kind of book club page turner.
It's so page turning. Like, it's just, yeah, I cannot think of a more absorbing book that is not a thriller that I've read for a long time. I loved it. And I cannot wait to see an HBO miniseries, which will inevitably be made.
With Reese Witherspoon.
I assume so. She does now.
So my next one, I think, also fits into a very similar category of gripping books that aren't really thrillers but sort of feel like it. I've picked My Dark Vanessa by Kate Elizabeth Russell, which was Fourth Estate's lead title this year.
May I just say that much like The Discomfort of Evening, I feel like these are literally from a different lifetime. Like anything that came out pre-Rona, I'm just like, that's not.
So that's this not, book, not now. It came out on the 31st of March this year, which I remember very clearly because I did the fucking launch, the Waterstones launch with Kate on Instagram Live. And it was very bizarre because it was not the event that we had planned or imagined. But yeah, I actually read it in 2019. Yeah, so it does feel.
For so long that, you know, we have been anticipating and read it quite early.
So if you haven't come across it yet, or if you haven't read it yet, it's set in 2017 when the hashtag MeToo movement was starting to gain momentum. It's about a woman who is in her 30s and she finds out that her beloved high school English teacher has been accused of sexual abuse by a former student. But this sends the main character, Vanessa, into a bit of a tailspin because as a teenager, she had actually had a sexual relationship with this man as well. But she did not consider herself to be a victim of abuse. She thought that she was in love and has spent her entire life up to that moment, like believing that she had had a consensual relationship as a teenager with her English teacher. So this kind of revelation forces her to rethink her past and rethink everything that had happened between her and this man, and then kind of come to terms with potentially redefining her first love and her kind of what she thought of as her sexual awakening. So it's a really, really intense book. I read it. I read a proof. I think I read half of it just on my sofa. You know, like when you really should be doing other shit, I was like, I need to wash up. I need to make dinner. I've got loads of stuff to do. But I literally just couldn't put it down. I got completely sucked in. Did you enjoy it?
I loved it. Yeah.
I loved it on a line level as well. Like the writing is incredible.
I'm very interested to see what she does next. Partly because I just feel like this book was such a labor that took so many years and is clearly so, if not literally personal, but generally personal to her, that I'm very interested in what someone who puts out a book like that chooses to do next.
It's really interesting following her Instagram account because she talks so much about the writing process of My Dark Vanessa. But it's also really great to see her kind of diving into a new project, which she's being very careful about, as you can imagine. She's keeping her cards close to her chest. But, you know, it's happening and it's exciting.
I'm hyped. Yeah, I love this book. I think it's a really useful, interesting, challenging thing to kind of confront the question of, like, what do we do with people who we would perceive to have been abused but do not perceive themselves to have been abused.
Exactly. It does what a term I came across this year, which is problematizing, which means not presenting a formed idea but presenting a situation which is kind of has no clean cut answers, and it is difficult to think about. And, you know, I think this book is a conversation starter in many ways. It definitely confronts something which we don't necessarily feel like we have to confront when we're talking about things like Me Too and sexual abuse, particularly on the internet. You know, like, the internet's a very black and white place, and this book is shades of grey. What next, chum?
In the Dream House by Carmen Maria Machado, which we have mentioned in the recent past, and we did a whole episode about memoir in the Dream House pre-lockdown. But it is a exploration of an abusive relationship that the author was in. And it is explored via various literary devices and themes and forms. And it's just a really inventive way of approaching memoir. And, you know, she's an extraordinary writer. She has an extraordinary imagination and a really incisive look at this very painful and difficult period of her life, which is not, you know, there's also a lot of kind of hope and light in it as well.
God, I love this book. I loved it.
Anything you'd like to add to that summary?
Just that I think that it, in terms of form, it's one of the most creative approaches to memoir that I've ever read. Yeah, I just thought it was absolutely incredible. And, you know, hard to read as well. Hard to read, but you're right that it's hope.
Little surprising, nice things in it as well.
Yeah. Oh, God, I love it. And you know what? I just cannot wait to see what she writes next.
Same.
Cannot wait. She's had a collection of short stories. She's had a memoir. She's just released a graphic novel with the Joe Hills label, whatever it's called.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know. I'm wondering, will it be a novel? Will it
She's just such a, like, an all-round creative force.
Yeah. Incredible mind. Incredible brain, you know?
If you want to read some, a kind of a memoir unlike what you have maybe encountered before, I cannot recommend that enough. And I know that you are behind this book as well.
Well, it was actually in my top five, but we compared notes to make sure that we had a full 10. And you very kindly let me pick something else to plug the gap.
Yeah.
Which I will get to later, because the next one on my list is another book that we've talked about recently. It's Tiny Moons by Nina Mingya Pals, which came out from the Emma Press, which is a really tiny, a micro press from the Midlands. And Tiny Moons is A Year of Eating in Shanghai. It's illustrated by Emma Wright, so it's a really beautiful little book. And yeah, it's just a super dinky travel diary, and it kind of explores food as a platform for memory and self-exploration, identity, and, you know, experiencing the world in new ways with new palettes and flavors. I loved it, and I felt like it was one of those incredible books that gained really exciting momentum.
Yeah.
Gail from the LRB bookshop. Yeah, she tweeted a picture of it when it arrived in their shop. And from, like, I saw that tweet and was like, yep, this looks wicked. I'm going to buy it. And yeah, it seems like everyone on Twitter with Gail, like, influenced us all and turned it into, like, a proper little bestseller.
But yeah, I mean, that's, I feel like that's where individual people can make a real difference to a book that is probably not gonna sell like thousands and thousands of copies. And I think that's really cool that, you know, things can, among a certain demographic in a certain community or whatever, really take off in a way that feels meaningful.
And I think it really shows, like, the power that independent bookshops have, because, you know, this is such a beautiful, like, incredible book. But it's not one that I would have expected to get in Waterstones when I was a bookseller. Like, yeah. It really is, like, it is the perfect title for those kinds of like curated selections that you find in indies. And I'm grateful for it.
It will make you want to travel and eat tasty things, which for many people is not on the cards right now.
Yeah, I feel like, no, but you're right, though, especially for this year, a year where no one is traveling and no one is necessarily being exposed to as many new foods as we would have been had we been able to travel, go to each other's houses, go to restaurants. It was like the perfect escapism in that way.
So my next pick was actually another memoir. So I've put two memoirs.
Oh, have you now?
It's very unusual. But I chose A Chiffon Trenches by Andrea Leontali, who was, for many years, the American editor-at-large of Vogue magazine. And it's just delightful. It's so juicy. He really doesn't hold back on celeb gossip. So it's pleasurable for that reason. But it's also just really pleasurable to read someone who is just incredibly knowledgeable about fashion, talking about fashion, who is not like a thin white woman. It's just, yeah, I really loved it. I loved it. And I really cannot recommend it enough. I read it as a hardback, but I bet it is incredible on audiobook. So if you've got an Audible credit going, I would spend it on that.
Do you ever get the audiobooks of books that you have already read and enjoyed?
No, I do not.
Interesting.
Oh, well, that's not... I mean, there's a famous exception.
Well, of course. It wouldn't be what page are you on.
You might have heard about a little book called The Crimson Petal and the White.
Never heard of her.
So that's the only book I've ever listened to on audio, having read it in paper form.
That's wild to me, because I do that all the time. I love to swap mediums.
Interesting.
Like, if I really love a book, my holy trinity is to have it on audio, the physical, and also digital to suit my various needs.
I love this. We're just, you know, as much as we are very similar, we also have a little difference.
Yeah. Oh, that's nice. Anyway, my next one is one that I know that you enjoyed as well. I've got True Story by Kate Reed Petty.
I loved this.
I loved this so much.
I feel like we should talk about this. Let's have an extended chat about this book, because I don't think this popped off as much as it deserved to.
I think it was a real... This is, for me, was a casualty of the pandemic.
Yeah.
It didn't get the same, like, controversy and buzz as My Dark Vanessa. But I just mean, like, I don't think it made as much of a splash, and it is splashy as hell. So when you say extended chat, do you mean now or later?
No, I just mean now. Like, oh, you know, instead cool. of just yeah. nutshelling the book, I think we could do a little...
Let's go in.
A little convo about this. So nutshell it for us.
Okay, so... You may be familiar with it if I describe it thusly. The Proofs actually had four different covers, which represented four different genres. A campus novel, psychological thriller, horror, and crime is the way that it was described. I actually feel like the covers don't necessarily reflect those four genres as clearly. Yeah, I feel like one looked a bit more romance-y, like the prom cover.
Yeah.
Anyway, but it's about a young woman who... in high school, passes out drunk and finds out later on that the two guys who took her home have been bragging about assaulting her, but she has no memory of the event whatsoever. The story is broken up between lots of different perspectives and also different forms of people who are tangentially related to the three people who are in the car. So there's like a good pal of the girl, there's a guy who's part of, I can't remember what sport it is. Is it lacrosse?
Lacrosse, I think, yeah.
Yeah. Weird that Americans go crazy for lacrosse, right? Like, yeah. And anyway, whatever. So yeah, like lots of different people have their say, but it's also spread over many decades. There's also like scripts in there. There's the girl's articles. I can't remember the main character's name. Is it Alice? But yeah, there's like her college essays, her entrance essays, like different drafts of those. So it's a really creative approach to storytelling. And yeah, it just kind of presents this idea of how these things can haunt us. Is that a good summary? It's quite a difficult one. It's quite a difficult one to nutshell.
And I guess it's also exploring like what is a true story and what is the true story here.
Sorry, I just realized I'm nodding because I don't want to interrupt you, but obviously you can't see that. Yeah, it's because I think that what superficially could have been potentially gimmicky, these different forms, but also the marketing approach of different genres, actually is completely intrinsic to what this book is, which was really refreshing. I like that.
I really like this book. The one thing I didn't like was the final cover that they chose, which I think was just an absolute misfire. So instead of either choosing a new cover for the book or choosing one of the four covers that they did for the Proofs, they made the finished cover one cover that has all four pictures on it, and I think it looks like absolute garbage. And if that was my book, I would be both furious and mortified.
It looks like a bad Instagram picture, doesn't it?
It's awful. It's so bad.
Like, it the really four covers,
because it doesn't say anything, you know. It by having all of those four on the cover, it ends up being confusing and not saying anything, rather than the kind of ambiguity of having the four different covers. Just come up with a new cover or choose the one that you think is the most appropriate. I don't know.
I mean, there are all, I think, that because they must have workshopped different ways to present all four covers. And I just think ending up with what looks like four books on a plain wood floor is an odd choice.
Just horrible.
You know? I'm curious to know what the paperback cover will look like. I reckon it'll be completely different. Logically, you'd expect them to do four different paperback covers, but maybe, you know, that would depend on how good the book sales were.
Just hope it's different, because I honestly think that cover will have put people off, or it won't have necessarily, if it hasn't put people off, it will not have drawn people to it.
That's the thing. I just don't think it's not as eye-catching as any of the four covers individually. The problem with picking one of those four covers is that I don't think any of them is a true representation of it. Because how can they be? Like, each one is representing a different angle or a different chapter or a different moment.
Yeah. I don't know what they should have done, but I can tell you what they shouldn't have done, and it's what they did.
I wonder if there would have been a way to have incorporated elements of all four genres into one image.
I'm sure there is, but we're not cover designers, so it's not our job to think of the right thing to do. But we are armchair critics. I say literally from my armchair. And I'm here to say, I hate the cover.
Yeah, agreed. But please do not be put off. Please go and buy True Story. Read it. It's an absolute time. And please let us know what you think of it.
That's another real page turner, I think.
I think so. And also, because it looks chunky, but the way that it's kind of written, you know, all these different forms means it's actually a much quicker read than it looks.
You get through it pretty quickly. Also because it's juicy.
What have you got next on your list?
So my final pick, we've come to the end of my five. My final pick is The Vanishing Half by Britt Bennett, which we've
times.
You are listening to right now. I will nutshell, and it's because it's pretty easy to nutshell. The concept is quite straightforward. It's about a set of twins who grow up in a town in the south of America where everyone is black but is quite light-skinned, and one day they run away when they're in their teens and at some point separate in their early 20s. And one lives their life as the black woman that she is. And the other decides to pass as white and lives as a white woman for the rest of her life. And it's just about those two women's futures and how they pan out and whether or not they are reunited. And it is just such a compelling concept, and she executes it so elegantly and so thoughtfully and very empathetically.
I agree. I'm only about 2 hours into the 8-hour audiobook, so about a quarter of the way in. And I definitely found it started off a little bit slow for me.
Yeah, you want to get straight into the bit of the story that you have heard
exactly
about.
And like, I actually started with the hardback and I swapped to audio because hardbacks just piss me off. I don't like them. So that's another example of me switching forms to suit my whims.
It's multimedia.
And that it was because of your recommendation. I think if you hadn't said that the audio is great, I probably would have just stuck with the hardback. But you're right, the audiobook is so good.
Yeah, I really recommend it. And it's not like mega long, so it doesn't meet my value for money threshold. But I think in terms of, you know, I'm really pretty stingy with the whole book length thing on my audiobooks. So I think 8 hours is a very normal length of a book. And the audiobook is great, and it's a great way to consume The Vanishing Half.
I love that you have a threshold of like ideal length for audio, and it's like 30 hours,
I mean,
which
that
is.
That would be a dream.
But that is my hell.
I want it to last forever. But yeah, this one, yeah, I think it's great. And if that's like a good way for you to consume the book, I strongly recommend it. It is a wonderful book. And I think
a very worthy addition to our top 10 of the year, because I do feel like it's a book that made a big splash as well. Like, it's something that like definitely kicked off online.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Which always excites me. I like to see like everyone reading the same thing.
This was definitely that in the summer. What's your final pick, my dude?
Okay, so my final pick, this is the one that I snuck in lieu of In the Dream House, and I've gone with Wow No Thank You by Samantha Irby, which is an essay collection that was put out by Faber this year. It's her third collection, and basically Samantha Irby's writing life started as a blog called Bitches Got to Eat, which I love, and she just has this fucking hilarious, really cynical, like quite negative voice which I just find so compelling. She's so interesting. She writes essays that feel very much like blog posts in that they are very personal. They're very funny. She generally will have like a subject that she's writing around and then will include like lots of kind of autobiographical information in there as well. So I feel like over the course of these three collections, I've learned all about her life and her career and her various gripes.
Many gripes.
Many, many gripes.
She has many gripes. But I just think she's so funny. And like, yeah, even though we have very different outlooks on life, I love reading her writing. I think she's so funny. I think she's hilarious. I think she writes really well. I listened to this on audio, which I recommend, but she has a very specific style. And I think you could find it quite hard to listen to if you were not vibing with it.
Interesting. That makes me want to just listen to a little sample and see what the vibe is.
Yeah, it won't surprise you. When you listen to it, you'll be like, ah, yes, this is exactly what I thought she would sound like reading this book. But yeah, I think I really enjoyed it. It frequently made me laugh. And I just love her. I think she's hilarious. I follow her on Instagram. I just love her. I love her.
Yeah, considering like how negative her general outlook is, she brings so much joy into my life. Like,
yeah, it's like controlled and non-bitter negativity.
Exactly,
she
exactly.
Doesn't have the bitterness that turns me off in other people. She just is quite cynical.
And in many ways, quite relatable to me. Like, there's this fucking hilarious bit. I can't remember which collection this is in now. But she talks about accidentally ordering a load of, like, special weight loss ready meals, which is a vibe I don't normally connect with, but, you know. But she accidentally orders them to her office. And she describes herself as being someone who likes to remain inconspicuous. So this massive delivery really pisses her off. And I just love that so much. The desire of, you know, not drawing too much attention to yourself when you're doing something a bit weird. I just love it. And that's the end of the list.
We have reached the end. So we have a little top 10 for you.
It interests me to see that we have a total of 4 non-fiction books.
Yes, that's very unusual, isn't it?
That's very unusual.
I wonder what that says about us, or about the market, or about this year. I don't know.
I honestly think it indicates to me that I haven't enjoyed fiction as much this year as I normally do. Because I reckon, maybe Tiny Moons is an exception. No, actually, come to think of it, I was going to say, I feel like I've probably loved the nonfiction that I've read this year as much as I have in previous years, but fiction would normally trump nonfiction for me. But come to think of it, I feel like Tiny Moons is so special, and In the Dream House for me was so special. And also maybe like Samantha Irby was filling a gap that I had this year that I wouldn't normally necessarily have. Like, I read a lot, all of her essays I read on my Kindle late at night when, instead of sleeping. And maybe normally I sleep better because there isn't a pandemic.
So true. And yeah, in terms of pure pleasure of reading, The Chiffon Trenches is the book that if we're going to go for just pure enjoyment, that is my most enjoyed book of the year. So it should be there.
I love that you're like, choice for pure pleasure is something that I probably will not read.
True.
You know, like, it just shows, once again, we diverge.
We do diverge. We diverge in many ways, but ultimately, our buddies.
We're on the same page.
We are on the same page.
Yay!
This isn't our last episode of the year, is it?
No, we'll do one more.
We'll do one more. We'll put out one on the 18th, and then that's your lot.
Yeah. Then we'll have a little Christmas holiday.
Yes, and return stronger than ever in 2021.
Which I, for one, can't wait.
Well, if you are listening to this on Friday morning when it comes out, you are still able to contribute to the PayPal pool for our fundraiser for Book Trust. So find that where you find it. You know where to find it. It's in my bio. It's a pinned tweet on my timeline on Twitter. Pinned tweet on the What Page Are You on Twitter. Any amount gratefully received. We are truly overwhelmed by how nice everyone is. Alice, have you got anything you'd like to say before we disappear?
No, that's it from me.
Well, we will see you next time.
Bye. Cheers. Bye.